Welcome to ITE 1.4.1, Module 8, Part 3. Before we start, does anyone have any questions? Okay, I guess everybody's good. I did also want to announce that after next week, they're doing a practical exercise and exploration, but after next week, we are commandeering the Wednesday time slot. So we will have 2 hour-and-a-half lectures at one on Wednesday from 9 to 10:30 Perth time, that is 8 to 9:30 Central, and one on Thursday. This will allow you all to get into bed earlier, and we'll get through more modules, and it will be all good, unless anyone has any real objections.
And if you have an objection, there is a recording.
That should be fine, I think, for me.
Anyone have any objections? If you can't make it, can you drop instructors an email or something so that we don't chase you? But it will give you guys, because you guys have still got another five modules to go.
All right, cool. Well, if nobody has any objections, then we'll do that not this week, but next week. Well, there'll be an announcement. So, yes, it will. That's okay. She can listen to recordings. She'll be all good. All right. Anything on labs or anything? Is anyone having any trouble with labs or any of that before we start and go into the reference models? Okay. So I guess nobody has any questions. So I will start with the TCP/IP reference model.
Well, before you even start with the model, the reference model, does anybody know why we have a reference model? Why is she about to go on with this stuff that will turn your brain into silly putty?
Because it makes it clearly defines how things communicate on a network. You know, what modules talk to what programs talk to what. I hope that makes some kind of sense.
Absolutely.
A model is a way of looking at an abstract concept that would turn your brain to goo. So it's like something else. It's like this. It breaks it down into manageable units so that you can look at the various protocol functions and look at what they do and see what the model does, and that way you can look at the different sections of the protocol. Otherwise, the networking is one big black box blob that you can't actually look at, and you're just like, I don't understand this, and I don't know where to start.
Okay, so we have two different layers of models. Now, the first thing you need to know about models is they are virtual, meaning that these are virtual. They're not real. These things don't actually really happen. So they're just virtual, and they're a model of what would happen. But you don't have this little assembly line inside of your computer, and this is not actually really happening. And they actually had to point this out in the text this year. They didn't last year. So, yes, this is virtual, guys.
Wow.
But I think we know that, right? Okay. So the first and less complicated, but then again less descriptive model is the TCP/IP model.
No, I'll just describe less complicated from that, and I'll give you the other two. But yeah, TCP has its own complexities, trust me. It just has fewer layers, so you think it's easier.
Comparatively speaking?
No, it's still complicated. And when you get into the protocol design of TCP/IP, it's probably more complicated than the OSI reference model, because the OSI reference model has better divisions.
So the TCP/IP has four layers. A message starts at the top layer called the application layer. This layer provides the programs you use with the resources they need to access the internet. The protocols that the access layer work with include HTTP, POP3, IMAP, and SMTP. Those are just a few of the ones that you'll see in the application layer. Next, your message moves to the transport layer. In the transport layer, your data is broken into packets. The protocols used in the transport layer ensure that your data gets from one end to the other. One transport layer protocol is called TCP. TCP stands for Transmission Control Protocol, and is the primary internet protocol for the reliable delivery of data. TCP includes facilities for end-to-end connection establishment, error detection, and recovery. It also meters the rate of data that flows into the network. Many standard applications such as email, web browsers, file transfers, and Telnet use TCP. because they need to make sure that every single packet gets to you. And if a packet gets lost, that it gets retransmitted, because you don't want to lose any packets, because then everything's going to be scrambled and bad. Now, another transport protocol is called UDP. And UDP stands for User Datagram Protocol. This offers a connectionless service for delivery of data. UDP uses lower overhead than TCP and does not provide reliability. Network management, we're not going to go there yet.
Just a quick explanation. The difference between TCP and UDP, you can think of UDP as a cannonball. In other words, you launch your message into a cannonball and you shoot it off, and you don't know whether the ship's going to sink or whatever. You don't even know whether the cannonball lands in the right spot. But there's a good chance that you've aimed your cannon correctly and the ship's going to go glub, glub, glub to the bottom of the ocean, or that the UDP packet is going to be received. So it really is a fire and forget mechanism.
Whereas with TCP, somehow somebody does come and tell you, oh yeah, it really died, it really sank, it's really sank, or that it worked.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. In fact, it goes, you know, boom, and then TCP goes, thunk. And then you go, oh, I got the thunk. Oh no, I didn't get the thunk. Okay, load the cannon again, guys. Boom, thunk. Oh, I got it that time.
Okay. So what kind of applications do you guys think you might have UDP set up for?
I can immediately think of Shoutcast.
No.
Ventrilo.
No. Ventrilo, yes. Shoutcast, no.
Shoutcast, yeah?
No.
I think it uses HTTP and UDP, though, doesn't it?
XM Radio.
No.
No. That's satellite. No. Online, if you were listening to it, I'd say yes.
No.
Yeah, that's what I meant, online, XM Radio.
Ventrilo, okay. I'll use UDP.
Yeah.
Okay, can we be happy here that MP3 streaming does not use UDP? So Shoutcast doesn't,
yeah, right.
Winamp doesn't, it's all TCP. Ventrilo, Skype, TeamTalk, yep.
I thought
it
I would
could be
think
quite
that,
interesting when
MP3
you type in the wrong server buffering. Port, because you could end up in a completely different place, because there's no acknowledgement, so you could end up somewhere you really didn't mean to go.
Whoops.
No, the reason it doesn't use UDP, guys, is because MP3 streaming can work through HTTP proxy servers, so by definition it has to be TCP, because you can tell Winamp to use a proxy server.
Also, that's why you end up having buffering problems and dropouts and the like. If it was UDP, then it would go in a continuous stream, but you would lose part of the song, which is just as bad if not worse.
That's right.
But yeah, Skype, Ventrilo, all those do use your UDP.
Speak freely.
Why?
SIP stuff.
Because SIP is more interested in low delay. Transfer. So if you've got all the overhead of TCP and the internet connection goes down for a second, the whole stream of data is stalled for that 1 second while the connection goes down. So I could be talking and then it would come back, and that would be really annoying. Whereas it would rather be better for it to go, I'm talk back, and it just drops the bit that it doesn't get. That's much more sensible for a voice thing, because you can actually you just try listening to, like, old people. You can get away with listening to 30% of what they say, and you still get what the conversation is. So that's old true people. With voice over IP,
I did that to everybody.
Yes.
I did that to absolutely everybody I talk.
We noticed.
I guess so.
I'm sure. Yeah, it works.
So,
works.
My
doesn't
Ventrilo
work.
Does that anyway.
100% of
Ventrilo,
the time, you'd be amazed how effective.
Ventrilo uses TCP to show that you're on the server, and it uses UDP for the actual voice transport, and then it uses another UDP protocol called Sync, Synchro something, that actually synchronizes the voice stream. So it actually uses three different streams. So let's not go too heavily into Ventrilo except to say that, yes, it does use UDP.
Is that what causes it to get all weird, like when I disconnect and I'm way behind, and I will, like, actually disconnect, and then I will still hear someone talking for, like, a minute and a half?
Yep.
Even though I've, ripped the network cable out of the computer, and it can't possibly...
Yeah, because it's just going to keep playing.
It'll just keep going. It's
Skype
impressive.
Skype uses UDP because one time I was talking to my friend, and we were on Skype, and neither of us had internet. Like, I don't know, I think Time Warner was having, or because we used the same ISP, and yet we were still on Skype, but nothing else worked. We couldn't do the web, we couldn't do IM, but Skype still worked.
No, that was no DNS.
No, that was a DNS problem.
Oh, okay.
No, if Instant Messenger didn't work, then it...
No, Instant Messenger still uses DNS.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, for the... Yep. Yeah. The gateways, right.
But Skype doesn't, so you could still be on Skype, even if the DNS server was down.
What does DNS stand for again?
Domain name resolution.
No, it stands for domain name system, because resolution doesn't start with S.
You're right.
Then they have the term DNS resolution.
It has to do with domain name resolution. I'm epic failing today, too.
It's a system for domain names.
Carol says, how do they spell it in America? Thanks, Carol.
Yeah, it's spelled DNSOR instead of OUR.
Okay.
Would you like a coffee, Grace? I can at least do that.
Yeah, go get me a coffee. That'd be fantastic.
All right, guys, so if you get a curly question in the next 5 minutes, I'm not here to answer it. Have fun.
Caffeine is good.
Okay.
I have confidence in our instructor.
Thank you, Drew. Okay, so any other questions on TCP, UDP?
Actually, Carrie did a very interesting, if you go back to Discovery Chapter 6, Part 1, or it's like 1 and 2, he did a very interesting and entertaining analogy about the difference between TCP and IP. Remember that one?
Well, I don't know that we should probably do that analogy because it's really politically incorrect.
Yeah.
But if you want to hear it, go back.
But if that's what I'm saying, if you want to hear it, it's there. It's certainly how I remember.
Yeah.
How much extra overhead does TCP IP add to the connection as opposed to UDP? Like, how much of a... Like, in percentage-wise,
actually,
or times, or whatever?
I couldn't actually tell you that, but it does slow it down. Actually, I think I saw somewhere in the notes that error checking can slow something down by up to 40%, and checking that the packets are there. Not sure, but...
Yeah, I believe that, too, from watching radio.
And it sends more data as well, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
So that's fun
it
for
does.
Cat.
Because it's all... UDP is there's no error checking, so it's going to go a lot faster, but you're going to miss stuff.
Yeah, that's fun for bandwidth caps,
but
I imagine.
But one little packet
if,
in a
know,
voice conversation
almost
doesn't
half
matter.
Of your data is... Right.
Because our brains...
I'm just saying that
kind of
sucks for people with bandwidth caps, because if, like, half of your data is error checking, correct?
Yeah.
But most of your data is TCP, so that's how it goes.
Yeah.
Okay, the next layer, the third from the bottom, is called network management. Oh no, I'm looking at the wrong thing. Oh, okay, yep, I'm seeing where I am. Cool. All right, now we're going to the internet layer, and the protocol that is used in the internet layer is called IP, Internet Protocol. This provides source and destination addressing, much like the address and return address on a postal envelope. In conjunction with routing protocols, IP provides packet forwarding information from one network to another. ICMP also works on this layer. Remember our ping exercise last week with ICMP? And ARP, Address Resolution Protocol, is used to obtain the MAC address of a node on the network when its IP address is known. Routers use ARP to discover MAC addresses of end stations, and end stations can send out requests to find out MAC addresses of other end stations. And finally, the network access layer is the lowest layer of TCP/IP model. This layer deals with physical access to media, such as cabling and wireless. The other more commonly used model is the OSI network model, but before we go on to that, does anyone have any questions on TCP/IP?
You couldn't just put those four layers again, could you?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask, really zippy.
Absolutely.
Just what they want.
Bottom up, we have network access, internet, transport, and application. You're not going to be asked much about this model because it's not as widely used. What the model that you really need to be concerned about is this OSI reference model that we're going to go through.
Yeah.
And I find it much easier to understand than the TCP/IP because it's got more layers and you get to go through the whole encapsulation process. You actually know what devices work at what layers, and it's really a much better model, hence why it's used more.
And
any other questions
really cool
on that?
Acronym thing to remember correctly as well, but I can't remember.
Oh, there's a bunch of really cool acronyms.
And I've got another
Google
one.
For.
I'm going to give one of the more tame on the politically incorrect spectrum acronyms later, having to do with Australia Post. But if you really want to go find some really rude, awful acronyms to remember your OSI reference model, just Google it up and you will find appalling, appalling stuff. It's really good. Someone else had something to say?
Which may assist in you remembering it, depend on the kind of person you are. If you're like me and that kind of stuff tends to stick.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Rich.
I was just going to say that also the internet layer is also referred to as the networking layer.
Yeah, depending. Go internet.
Is it though? Because would that not confuse the issue with the call it, the network access layer?
The OSI reference model. I would go with internet layer as much as you can, just for simplicity's sake.
No. You meant on TCP, didn't you, Rich?
No, and I'm just talking about the TCP IP. Sometimes the internet layer is also referred to as the networking layer.
It's the network layer, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm saying that would get confusing.
But then you have network and network access.
Yeah,
so go with internet as much as you can. But honestly, look at the four layers once before you go over the, before you take the quiz for the TCP IP, and then don't worry too much about it, because it's not nearly as important as this next one, which I wrote a fantastic explanation up of, and I'm really proud of myself, so yay. Okay, so the more commonly used model is the OSI reference model. This model has 7 layers. Does anyone want to show off and tell me from the bottom up what these layers are?
I do.
Do you? Go ahead, Curtis.
Physical, data, network, transfer, session, and I forgot what that other P was, but then the last one is application.
Okay, you're so close. We've got physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. Really close. Really, really, really good job.
Just missed one.
You did. And if you join Discovery or Exploration, you too will be able to do that. Oh, I've got mine. We're not to the acronyms yet. But we can do the acronyms now. You have the books, very tame, please do not throw sausage pizza away. But you know what you also have, and Australians, especially Karen, will be able to relate to is...
That one's the... Which way does that acronym go? Is that
physical
top or bottom... No, physical. I mean, which direction? Okay.
Physical.
Bottom up.
Yeah, physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Please do not throw sausage pizza away.
Throw sausage pizza away. So, if you want to go from the top to the bottom, just remember, Australia Post sucks. They never deliver parcels.
I thought that might actually ring a bell for you there. We've all been there.
Yeah, that's good. So that will at least make you laugh and help you to possibly remember the top down.
It's not tested in this test.
Yes, it is.
The order of all the layers?
There's something about the OSI reference model in there, but
yeah, but I don't think the order of
not,
the layers
it's
is
not top
what
down.
What they do is they ask which layer or which is the number of the layer, and then you gotta figure out what it is, I think.
Oh, okay, cool. So you'll want to know the layers.
Layer
you don't have to actually put them all in order, though. Anyway, extra super brownie lollipop points to Curtis for actually even trying that, and good job. Okay, a system that implements protocol behaviors consisting of a series of these layers is known as a protocol stack. Protocol stacks can be implemented in either hardware, software, or a combination of both. A good rule of thumb to remember is that typically the lower layers deal with hardware, physical, data link, network, and the higher layers take care of software, transport, session, presentation, application. When you send data, it travels virtually down through the OSI reference model, and each layer prepares your data to be sent. Think of it as an assembly line, or probably even better, a Subway restaurant. You get your bread, then it goes and they ask you what cheese you want. Do you want it toasted or not? You know, the meat and then all the salad, the salt and pepper and the dressing, and there's your OSI reference model.
Except it uses UDP because you can't hear the girl across the other side behind the six others when you say that you don't want jalapenos.
Which layer represents the toasted six?
That would be the physical layer. No, no.
That's physical?
That
no, bread's physical.
Layer.
Application? Oh, yeah, no, that would be
physical.
Like the...
I don't know.
We weren't going to get that far into it, Lord.
We weren't going there, but hey.
And then, of course, in Subway, you're like, okay, I'm moving over. How far do I move over before I get out of where the person can hear me? Because there's not a really big line.
What do I even have?
To. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You pay the girl, sure too. Enough. That's also part of it.
Yeah. You do, and then you drop your sandwich on the floor, and it's packet loss.
Oh.
Anyway, this is called encapsulation. So we're going to go through the encapsulation of an email message that you sent to your friend, telling them how sad you were that you dropped your Subway sandwich and you had to buy another one. Okay.
Now, thank your lucky stars, people, because in expiration you get the OSI reference model horse race, okay? You're not going to get that today.
No. We're going to go through this slowly, layer by layer, and we're going to understand it well as best we can. All right, so we're going to start at the top with layer 7, which is called the application layer. This is responsible for providing network access to applications like your email client. So it makes sure that you can see the email.
Oh, great. So the top layer is numbered 7? Okay, I didn't catch that.
Yeah. Until remember, that top 7, bottom 1.
Okay. If you look at your happiness, and you are totally miserable, and you're 1 out of 10, and you're 1 out of 7, because this is the OSI model of happiness, and you're 7 out of 7, you're absolutely jubilant and ecstatic, before you crash back down to 1 out of 7, that will be the OSI happiness model. So 7 is the top layer.
Yay!
Application, I get the email. Anyway, all right, so now we're going to travel down to layer 6, which is the presentation layer. This makes sure reformats your data so that when the application layer on the other computer gets it, it's going to look the same way on your computer. So it makes sure that it's in a format that another application is going to be able to read. After that, we travel down to the
session.
I'm just trying to look at my notes. Session layer, which manages the connections needed to send the data between computers. This will open the session, keep it open as long as it needs to be kept open, and when it's done sending, we'll terminate it. Up to this point, we have referred to what is being sent as what.
What happened to the P? Did we skip it?
Data.
Or did
no,
I miss...
P is presentation.
Oh, okay. What it...
Yes, data's right. We've been referring to it as data. When it goes to layer 4, which is the transport layer, the data is broken down into manageable pieces called Transport Layer Protocol Data Units, PDU. Yes. For orderly transport across the network. So now it is no longer data, it's no longer one big stream, it's now PDUs.
So is that equivalent
are those
to
packets or is that completely different?
No.
This is different. It's not a packet yet.
It's actually technically segments, and segments are multiple packets that are tied together in some way, and then the segments get broken down into the packet level at the network layer, and then they get broken into frames at the data link layer.
Data link layer. And we're going there.
Okay.
But not yet, because we have to talk about what is added to these PDUs before they get sent on their merry way down the tree. So we add port numbers. So we're going to say that this is going to be sent to port 8, port 25, because it's going to be an SMTP. Sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers are also added here to ensure reliable data transport. As you might have already guessed, the transport layer is responsible for providing reliable data transfer and data flow control. Okay, so the PDUs, these segments, flow down into layer 3, which is called the network layer. This layer deals with logical addressing, such as IP addresses, and is the layer at which routers work. We're just saying that for simplicity. Yes, exploration students, we know all of the different, but this could happen. But for us right now, routers usually work at this layer. Here the logical addressing information and various other layer 3 control information is added, making the segments from the transport layer into packets. So now we've got packets. They still can be referred to as PDUs, but they are now packets. They can be referred to as PDUs all the way down to the physical layer.
A PDU is actually a protocol data unit, and the PDU only makes sense at a particular layer. So you can have layer 1 PDUs, layer 2 PDUs, layer 3 PDUs. So that's why you can refer to them as protocol data units all the way down, but it won't tell you how big the chunks are.
So you've got packets. So these packets are going to flow down to layer 2, the data link layer. This layer provides physical addressing and media access procedures, so they're going to get MAC addresses. Switches work at this layer of the OSI reference model. Physical addresses and error correction information are added to, and this turns the packets into frames. So you've got this big frame with all of this information, which finally lands in the layer 1 physical layer, which is responsible for all physical media and connections. Hubs work at this layer. Your cables are at this layer. Your wall jacks at this layer. The frames are transformed into bits, ones and zeros, which are transmitted across the network medium, your cable, your wireless, one at a time. At the other end, the process is reversed. The information travels up the OSI reference model and is de-encapsulated. Encapsulation and de-encapsulation are in your test. Encapsulation is when you are going to send something and it's getting encapsulated, turned from a segment to a packet to a frame, and then into bits.
Does that say de-encapsulate or does it just say decapsulate? Because I don't think there's an N in the D step.
I believe there is. It is de-encapsulate. I can look in the actual thing.
Well, it's not important right now, but we'll check that because I thought it was just decapsulate.
So I want to give you the right terms.
I can always search the notes and tell you. That's probably easier.
That's what I'm doing.
De-encapsulation.
Yes, I thought so.
Okay, they've made it more complex for you all. Okay, cool. When I went to TAFE, they called it decapsulate.
That would seem to make more sense.
Yeah, but it's okay. It's 2010 now. They can change things in the last 10 years.
Okay, so de-encapsulation...
We're paid a great amount of money to interpret these large words for people.
Absolutely. So they got to make it really complicated so that we just confuse everybody. All right. Bits become frames. Frame becomes packets. Packets turn up into segments. Then these PDUs become not PDUs anymore. Data goes up into the session layer. The session is terminated. It now has all the data. The data is formatted for the application layer, and then your friend opens her email and sees this rant about you dropping your Subway sandwich and goes, wow, what a drama queen. And this all happens in about 30 seconds.
And heaven help you if it doesn't happen in 30 seconds. I don't know, people seem to think email should be instantaneously delivered, and we used to have all sorts of trouble back in 1999 when somebody would send 6 photos of their puppy dog and wonder why the 50 meg email didn't turn up at 10 seconds to the other person's desk.
Email has a funny way of like taking over a connection when it's sending.
It does. It does take over a connection when it's sending. It just absolutely minces your upload bandwidth. It's done. If you're doing anything else and you send a big email, just go do something else.
Yeah, I was trying to send an email with a large Word document attached today, and it actually didn't go, and I had to pick another SMTP server. And then it went. I had to pick my ISPs instead of Gmails, and then it went.
Was it a lab?
Yeah, it was.
That's interesting, because Gmail's got like a 10 meg max message size. I would have thought that would be big enough for anything you wanted. I've seen songs of it.
Yeah, which is a violation of the terms of service, but moving on, you can actually, if you have, like, say, for example, 4 pictures from a digital camera at 5 megapixel shots in JPEG, that'll be 4 by 5 meg, which will be 20 meg. So you just go click, 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 and then you don't tick the box that says reduce my pictures to something reasonable before I hammer the mail server, and then you go finish, and then it tries to send out 20 meg and fails.
Yeah, but a Word doc?
Yeah, Word doc with lots of pictures.
Yeah, but it has all the pictures in. Yeah. I would love to have actually found a quick way to chop them out of my
images. We have.
Cause... Oh, how do you do that?
Just remove all the objects, John.
Yeah, just go Control Shift O, and then, you showed us.
You taught me how to do it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, handy JAWS tip. If you're a JAWS user and you want your Word documents not to hammer your machine every time you down cursor into one of those pictures that's 13.1 centimeters wide by 2.61 centimeters high, go Control-Shift-O, arrow down, find the objects you want to do, hit OK, and it'll go Chart Objects Selected, and then you hit Delete, and the picture goes bye-byes, and then your computer goes much faster.
And you have to do that.
I'm a JAWS user, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I know you do. Maybe that's done. Maybe. Yes! I think so.
Seem to be.
Yeah, I think we're
on. Yeah, sadly. Yeah, everybody else is happy.
Are you on your 3G?
Okay, I think we'll continue on. He'll chat back at us when he gets to it. He's probably a bit delayed.
Okay.
He'll get back to us.
He will get back to us. Okay, is that good? Are you guys good with this? If you get asked any questions on OSI reference model, the basics of it, will you be able to answer them? Is there anything you guys want me to go over? Any questions that you guys have about this model?
You might actually want to get this bit on your recording and then stick it on loop and just run it over and over while you sleep. And then when you wake up, you'll be going, no, session layer is the layer that establishes the session. Australia Post sucks. They never deliver parcels.
I actually think I get it better than I did last semester, so it makes more sense now than it did then, I think.
Well, third time's the charm, hey?
For me, it's like sixth time the charm, but, you know.
That's okay.
That's making me feel a lot better about things, Drew. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You don't have to get
this. I have trouble
with
this. It's my own fault, because I don't listen half the time, so I blame no one but myself.
Yeah, that's okay, we blame nobody but you as well.
Alphabet soup.
That's good.
That's okay.
No.
Go ahead. What are you
I've got the order down fantastic. It's figuring out what each layer does, like the actual important part that, you know, I have trouble with.
Well, honestly, and I hate to pat myself on the back, this is a very concise little bit about very basically what each layer does. So, and I might actually, honestly, take this bit out of my notes, clean it up, and post it to the list in text. Because would anybody want that?
Yes,
sure.
Please.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Yes.
That will show up, because it's seriously about a page.
That was been the loudest class response we've gotten all semester.
The other thing you can also do is if you Google up OSI reference model on YouTube, there's all sorts of Cisco videos that go through it, complete with animations and little bloop 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 noises as the packets move around. The OSI reference model consists of 7 layers. Off it goes, and it goes all the way up and all the way down.
Do they have like cartoon packets with little ears and stuff?
Yeah,
probably. Wow. That's disturbing.
Okay. So we've got mnemonics for the OSI reference model. If anyone finds any really good, fairly clean ones that you think are really awesome, you can post them to discuss if they're good and not really too dirty. And if they're really dirty, just email them to me privately.
Actually, you can Google up mnemonics, and that's how one of our previous students found the Australia Post one. There's a whole canonical page full, and you can just pick the one that you like the most.
So now, any questions on the TCP/IP or the OSI reference model before we move on?
How much do they overlap, I guess, as in the specific protocols, like... I'm assuming, you know, like a specific protocol or protocol suite or whatever will apply to both models. It's just a different way of explaining things. Is that right?
No, TCP/IP only applies to TCP/IP.
There is a mapping between the TCP/IP model and the OSI reference model, but I don't believe we cover it. There are certain layers that do the similar things and certain layers that do other things. The OSI reference model came out after the TCP/IP model, which is well established, which is why the TCP/IP model is still around.
Okay.
Yeah, they do have similar related functionality in different places. Yeah, because I remember hearing
there's a
one of the Discovery lectures I listened to.
Yeah, there's a diagram that you guys can look at. That shows what the similarities are. I didn't put it in because, quite honestly, I couldn't interpret it this morning. So, if you want to have a look,
I saw that. It's weird.
Yeah, it is beyond my visual capabilities to even understand that, so I just kind of left it. All right, anything else on those before we go into configuring stuff? Plugging it in, making it go, all that. Okay, in that case, I will clean up my notes and send them to the list. But now, we will talk about configuration of an NIC. Anyone tell me what an NIC stands for?
Network Interface Card.
Good job! All right. Okay. All right. Manufacturers update drivers for devices all the time to add features, fix bugs, and make them compatible with newer operating systems. Installing drivers, use common sense, aka disable antivirus software, close as many applications as possible, and only update drivers one at a time, because you don't want drivers trying to access the same files and not to update correctly. All right, what's the best place to find new drivers for any device? Test question.
The manufacturer's website.
Good job, that's absolutely right.
Now notice right. The question is, it's the best place to find the most recent drivers. It is not the best place to find the best drivers, the best place to find working drivers, or the best place to find the right drivers. It's just the best place to find the most recent drivers. Okay? Generally they work pretty well, but I'm just making that point.
And generally they're better than what you're going to get on Windows Update.
And the CD.
What isn't better than what you get on Windows Update?
To be fair,
most of the drivers that are 2 years old.
No, to be fair, the network drivers
that I've seen are not very good.
No, the network card drivers are pretty excellent. The video drivers are usually quite good. Occasionally you get a bad one. But the point about the Windows Update drivers is that they have been WHQL certified, which means that they have been quality checked by Microsoft.
I'd rather get a Windows Update sound driver than a, Realtek sound driver.
That can be fun.
I agree with you.
I mean, the motherboard one is the best overall, but yeah.
Yeah. You guys
one
get
sucks,
to actually
one won't it. Get you sound, so.
Yeah, basically. Now, you guys get to do a lab where you get to find drivers for a network interface card, and you're going to use the card on your computer. In fact, when you get to any lab where you need to choose a device, you have a choice. You can either ask me for one, or you can use any other device you'd like, any laptop you have, a friend's laptop, whatever. As long as you tell me what that device is, you can use it. And that makes things a lot more fun for you guys, because then you're actually working on a computer that you know or might have something to do with. But if you really are stuck, write me and I'll just give you specs for a random laptop.
If you are Toshibaing, csd.toshiba.com is your friend.
And get that little model number off your Toshiba, because that would probably help you out quite a bit.
Get the little model number off of any laptop. Like, seriously.
No, Toshibas have, like, these special model numbers.
Oh, they...
So, yeah.
It's like, it's a Toshiba Portage 3800, and then it's a U7165B7-100-5, and the 5 is important.
Yeah.
Because the 100-4 has got a completely different system board, so it better be the 100-5, and not the 100-5A, because that's different again.
Yeah, you definitely want, that's an instance where you definitely want to... I would just say, hey, whoever can see and is helping me, read, like, all of the numbers on all of the stickers,
yeah.
And then I get to be...
And then I'll sort it
out.
Out
which one I need.
Actually,
and then I'll sort it later.
This doesn't work for everybody, but a lot of them have barcodes, and if you swipe a barcode scanner in alphanumeric mode, it'll just go beep and give you the whole code off the laptop, and it's just like...
Oh, that's
ripper.
Cool.
And yep. it's actually got checked sequences, so it actually comes off correctly. The other thing I'd recommend, guys, and this is something that never got mentioned in the laptop model, but I'll mention it here. If you get a laptop and it's got an OEM version of Windows installed on it, get the product key off the bottom of the laptop before it rubs off.
We mentioned that in Module 5 for desktops and laptop computers, actually.
Did you mention that it rubs off, though?
Yes, that's why we said everybody get your serial numbers.
Yeah, you can use Magical Jelly Bean Key Finder to pull it out as well. However, it will tend to trip off the antivirus programs going, this program is a rogue program. It's not. It just retrieves your Windows key.
Magical Jelly Bean is awesome. You know, Bellark Advisor will also do it. Everybody should have Bellark Advisor.
It's only free for non-commercial use, though, so don't do it in a business, or they will come and they will attack you.
How would they know?
That's good.
Because it talks to their servers when it generates the HTML page.
Ah.
It's like Windows.
Bellark or both of them?
Bellark. Not Magical Jelly Bean.
Yeah, that's just...
That's just a little free program that you can use basically anywhere.
Your Magical Jelly Bean key finder is on magicaljellybean.com, if my memory serves.
Okay. So most drivers you get are self-installing, meaning you unzip them, and you click setup.x, and boom, 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 follow the bouncing ball, next, 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 hey, you have some drivers, maybe it'll ask you to restart. If you are unfortunate enough to get one that does not do this, extract it and put it in somewhere like ctemp. Just put it somewhere where you know where it is. Next, you're going to go to the device manager and find the device you want to update. Press Alt-Enter for its properties, Control-Tab to the update driver, or to the drivers tab, and press the update driver button. It'll probably ask you if you want it to go online to look for updates. You basically want to tell it you want to browse for the driver, point it at the folder where your driver is, and cross your fingers and pray that it will find it, recognize it, and install it.
Windows 7 users, beware! When you do a default install of Windows 7 and your hard drives are in AHCI mode, you will get the standard Windows bodgy dicey AHCI driver. If you have an Intel chipset, it is in your best interest to go and grab the Intel chipset and follow Grace's instructions and go update driver so that the Intel AHCI controller shows up, because it's much more efficient than using the standard AHCI driver. We had to do that on all of our netbooks because when we did our Windows installs, the default Windows driver went in, not the funky one from Intel.
Should probably do that to my notebook as well.
I wonder if I need to do that.
It's not in the Intel chipset driver bundle. It's actually a separate driver. You can tell by looking in your device manager and seeing if it says Intel AHCI rah-rah or whether it says standard AHCI SATA controller.
If you've got AMD, then your SATA RAID whatever will probably be through AMD, or ATI rather, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, and the sort of VIA stuff, because they bought VIA, so that's now all rebadged.
Do they still... Maybe it's VIA stuff rebadged as ATI. That would be okay, I guess. But yeah, VIA is not very good.
Not really. I've had some problems with VIA under Windows, to be honest. It does work well for some people, and it doesn't work well for others.
Yeah, if you're lucky, it'll work, and not much else can be said.
Okay, moving right along.
Okay. If that update fails or doesn't work right, if you have no sound, you can plug in a USB sound card and you can roll back that driver. Now, this is not going to work, obviously, and they actually had to say this in the textbook too, if you have never had a driver installed before and this is a first driver. Yeah, figures, because you don't have anything to roll back to if you've never had a driver installed. But if you have and you like that one better, you can, in the drivers tab, press the rollback button. It'll roll back your driver, and you'll have the old driver back again. Now, can anyone tell me where you can see the properties of your NIC adapters in Windows XP?
Can it be depending on what kind of properties you're looking for?
The actual properties, not the device manager properties, the actual properties where you're going to find, like, the TCP/IP, and be able to set it up.
Oh, I know. Oh, wait, okay. I can't.
Yeah, you can on this one. Nobody else has jumped up and said, I know, because we all just built around the control panel till we find it.
I think you go to network connections, and you find the network connection you want, and you right-click it, and you choose properties, and the support tab is going to have all kinds of fun stuff on it. Is that where we're...
Yep.
There is an easier way. Properties of my network places, find the connection there, and then properties of that. Bada-bing. But Sean's way will work.
That's how I do it. I do it your way, Sean.
You can actually, you don't even need to go to support. If you use your review cursor of choice, you can see pretty much the same info there.
The support tab actually,
up and down in.
Yeah, the support tab though does give you the DHCP renew release information, which isn't on the main status screen, and often that is the information you want.
But if I want that, I can just go and type in the ipconfig command and get it.
Except you've got to sift through the six IPv6 interfaces that happen to have popped up and the seven virtual network things.
Yeah.
But that happens under XP too. If you get a few, like once you've got VMware installed, you've got two network interfaces that clog it up.
If you ever put Hamachi on, you'll get another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. VMware and
OpenVPN.
Yeah, just make it pretty ridiculous. You just dump it to a notepad file and then are done with it. You don't use the window anymore at that point.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Hamachi is bad news, people. Be very careful. Whilst it will allow you to share files with your friends, if something goes wrong with your configuration, it will allow the internet at large to hammer your machine sideways. So, watch out.
And don't put your JAWS authorization number into the folder where you're sharing that you're sharing with all of your friends, because then they will all have your JAWS authorization number. Yeah, that was my moronic sister.
Oh, jeez. I was gonna ask if you'd seen someone do it, but you just answered that.
Yes. Yes, I have.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well, we got that mess cleaned up. That was fun. But now she knows not to do it anymore.
Okay, let's keep moving.
Yeah.
We've still got some Chapter 8 and possibly some 9 staring down the barrel at us.
We do. All right. So, can anyone tell me how to get to network properties the properties of your NICs in Windows 7?
Come on, guys, have a go. If you get it wrong, we won't laugh and jeer at you. We'll just teach you something.
I said praying. I think that's quite accurate.
No.
Yeah, you hit the start button, and then you type in what you think it might be, and then you say 7 mantras, and then you arrow down, and it might be in that list. And then you press enter. Exactly. And then
5.5.3, anybody?
Oh, is it an administrative tool?
No, it's under the control panel in the network. And you go in there.
Okay, it's control panel, network and sharing, and then you're going to go to change adapter settings. And there is going to be all of your...
I would have never got that.
And I see.
There are other ways in it too, but that's good.
With that lab last week.
You can actually do the networking stuff without the network and sharing center. We don't recommend it, but there are actually other ways in to actually bypass all that silly dialogue.
Yeah, I got to sit with Drew last week and help him with that lab. We had a good time.
We did have a good time.
That's why I didn't get it, because I don't have 7 to try it.
Yeah, no, you get to do it the easy way. And I only dubbed Drew in because he mentioned that we sat there and did it together. So, yeah. Now that the NIC is configured, plug in an RJ45 cable if it is a wired NIC. Plug the cable into your network device or into the wall. If you have light perception, then see if there is any activity on the linked LCDs on your NIC. If not, you're going to have to do something else, like see if, like run an IP config if you think that
look
you
in
might
one of
have
the 5 different places address to tell if your internet connection is working.
Yeah, basically.
Or wave an AM radio near your network cable, and if it does... You've got Link, and that's another way of doing it. If you can't find the 5 places in Windows 7, but you can find your radio.
I have one sitting on my desk. I have to try more of that.
You should. It's really a cool technique, and you don't think about it, but once you start using it, it's really cool. You can find so much information out by listening to the electronic interference of radios.
That might be fun. I've got 2 computers fairly close together.
It's pretty crazy, yeah.
It's unbelievable what you can do and how much more information you can get out of it. And yeah.
Gives you an idea of how much is really going on in the world that you have no idea.
Oh, if you want that, you go netsh dump from a command prompt, and then you run screaming. That's
okay.
Bizarre.
What, you do that with FM radio?
No. This is if you're looking for
network
information. You go netsh space dump space greater than quote a big long file that I'll never read .txt quote, and then you can open it in Notepad, and there it all is, and it's frightening.
If there is no activity, this might indicate a faulty cable, a faulty hub port, or even a faulty NIC. If this is the case, it's probably time to troubleshoot. Try replacing the cable first if you've got another one, because it's very likely a bad cable. Change the ports around, see if the port will actually work, or maybe the NIC didn't install properly or is completely faulty, so you get to have some troubleshooting fun there.
This could indicate that something somewhere has gone wrong.
Yeah, I think it does, basically. Most networks are set up so that the computer receives an IP address automatically. And what would give the network a IP address automatically, guys? Yes, it would. Good job. Yes. If the computer does not have an IP address, you must enter a unique IP address in the TCP IP properties of the NIC, which you will find in either of those places that we just discussed. Every NIC must be configured with the following information. Protocols. The same protocol must be implemented between any two computers that communicate on the same network. It's usually going to be the TCP IP protocol now. IP address. This address is configurable and must be unique to each device. Hey, you know what? That's kind of assuming that you have TCP IP and that's a protocol you're using, so that makes, yeah. It can be manually configured or automatically assigned by DHCP. A MAC address, which each NIC has burnt into it already, so you don't have to actually assign that or anything. It cannot be changed easily. It says it cannot be changed in the notes, but yeah, you can change it. After you've connected the computer to the network, use the ping command to test it. Ping Google, ping your default gateway, ping computers on your network to make sure the local network's working properly. You can run the IP config command. Anyone up for a little demonstration of IP config and what it does? Has everybody done this? Has anybody not done it? If not, we'll go through it.
Yeah, I've done
it. I haven't done it.
Okay. We'll do it. All right. So you're going to run a command prompt. So that's a Windows R, and then you're going to type CMD and press Enter.
Which is Charlie Mike Delta, in case you can't tell whether it's CND, CDN, or anything else. It's CMD, Charlie Mike Delta, and then depress the return key.
Okay, next, you're going to type in...
CMD is in command.
So you're going to type in IP, as in India Papa. Config, C-O-N-F-I-G.
And then just start with that. We don't need the switch because they can just see the first bit that's smaller.
I think you do need the switch.
No, you don't.
If you don't need the switch, it'll scroll off. Oh, no, that's if you run. Just run it from the... So now just press Enter.
168.100.blah. Yeah, that's your IP address.
Now, if you want to see more information than you probably ever wanted, all of your IP address information, you type in ipconfig space slash all and press Enter.
For every network card you have.
Is there a way in Windows... Because Windows 7 appears to default to ipconfig slash all. Is there any way to, like, slim that down a little bit?
No, it just has lots of interfaces. I think it actually doesn't put all the information in. I think it actually just has, like, virtual IPv6, IPv6 tunnel, Teredo 2.
Right.
So it's just lots of interfaces. You can actually go through, at the risk of breaking things... and go and disable all the IPv6 interfaces under Network and Sharing Center and go disable, 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 and they'll disappear from that view if you're not using IPv6.
I may, because it is very annoying.
What is IPv6?
Oh!
The new standard of internet protocol that you will learn about if you listen to the file in the Thursday chat section of 2007, where I give a big talk about it. Essentially, it's 128-bit address space, lots and lots of machines, security, compression, and all sorts of things that will turn your brain to jello.
It's basically, we're running out of IPv4 addresses, and that's about it. It's the new standard of IP addresses, so we don't run out.
Now, the only other thing we should point out is that if you're doing an ipconfig space slash all, you can also, if you've gone cd space desktop first, obviously, so you cd space desktop, which will put you into your desktop, and then you go ipconfig space slash all, space greater than, which is the crocodile facing to the left, or shift full stop, ipconfig.txt, and then you can read it in Notepad. That makes it a lot easier, because otherwise you end up mucking around with scroll bars, and it all scrolls off your screen faster than you can say, wow, I probably should have downsized my font in my large print application before that whipped by.
Or you can dump it into a WordPad, which might work better in Windows 7.
Yeah, Notepad's kind of broken under 7.
I noticed that I had that when I forget if it was a dir I tried to do, or there was something I tried to do yesterday on the command line, and it's like, whoa, I didn't expect that much text, and I was trying to scroll.
You can actually, there's scroll up and scroll down symbols that you can click with your mouse. It's just not a lot of fun to do it, but you can actually scroll up about 1,000 lines of text if you're patient enough with the left click button and the JAWS cursor.
If I could get the JAWS cursor to stay on the scroll up symbol, that'd be fine, but it tries to move.
Oh no, you've got to move it every time you click it. That's just part of the fun.
Yeah. What fun?
Okay.
And to close your command prompt, type exit, because Alt F4 doesn't work.
Oh, yeah. I did just kind of leave you guys there. Sorry. We got talking about something else. You can ping your own IP address to make sure that your NIC is working properly. And after you have determined your NIC is working, ping your default gateway or another computer on your network. And the default gateway allows you to communicate outside of your network.
Now, just one point that the notes don't seem to have managed here. Keep in mind that if your firewall is enabled, your pings aren't going to come back, okay? So if the Windows firewall is on, ping is going to break unless you've specifically gone into advanced firewall properties and ticked allow ICMP, which is something I always forget to do.
Alright, if you can get your default gateway, devices on your other network, devices outside of your network, obviously you're good to go. So you can go on with your life and start using the internet. If not, it's time to troubleshoot. Try all three pings, and what you do with that, or which pings work, depends on what you're going to troubleshoot.
Was one of them ping the local host? I'm sorry, did I miss that?
Yeah, you ping yourself. You can ping yourself.
Actually, pinging localhost will test the network stack, and pinging the IP address of your network card will prove whether you've got link or not, and that the actual IP stack is up, which is different to pinging localhost.
No, localhost, what is your or your loopback address? Does anyone know the number of your loopback address?
Come on, a couple of you explorationers should know this one.
127.0.0.1.
Well done. Good job, guys.
I had to file some students there for a minute.
Put out. There's actually been a doormat that says there's no place like 127.0.0.1.
You know, I love it.
On a t-shirt.
They probably have t-shirts.
It's probably also worth saying that you can also go ping space localhost because there is an entry for it in Windows System 32 drivers, etc. hosts. So you can just go ping space localhost, all one word.
And I've just given you guys the answer to a bonus question on 8.3.2. So there you go. Now you can all fill that up.
I refuse.
Telnet? You've already done it. Telnet, as well as ping and traceroute, can be used to verify connectivity. Telnet is a protocol that provides remote access to servers and networking devices. Telnet specifies how to create and terminate sessions to a remote computer or device. It also provides the syntax and order of the commands that can be issued during a session. It can be used to make configuration changes to a remote device, such as router or switch, and with the correct permissions, you can start and stop processes and even shut down a remote device. To support Telnet, you need a Telnet client. Windows has one, funnily enough, called Telnet.
Not installed by default under Windows 7, as we found out.
Really?
Yeah, Brian was telling us. It's not installed by default. You've got to go and add it in or it doesn't work.
Oh, that's a pain.
Where does one do that?
Do you have to have the DVD in the drive to do that?
Probably download it from somewhere.
No, you don't have to have it in, I don't think. It's part of the cached crud on the hard drive in C Windows cached crud, and it can pull it from there. However, it probably pays to have either your Windows 7 DVD or a Daemon Tools image of it handy.
Because you just should. but honestly, if you're going to play MUDs, which is one of the only reasons you guys in this class will probably be using Telnet, get a MUD client.
With a note that VIP MUD is broken under the latest snapshot of NVDA because they changed something and Tyler can't figure it out. Okay, moving on.
Most operating systems include Telnet clients, as I said. Telnet is run from the command prompt. It's a command line application. You're going to type commands in Telnet.
Does that work on the iThing? Because I saw Dad the other day turn off the router from the iPhone. It was quite trippy. I've never seen anything quite like it, and I'm assuming that's how he did it.
Yeah, he just went into the web interface with Safari and then clicked the reboot button.
That he probably didn't Telnet in. You can Telnet on the iThing, though.
Yeah, you need a third-party app from the App Store, but yes, you can.
Okay.
If he's not a technically savvy user, he probably didn't manage to Telnet.
You can even
I go, that's sad. He knows more about this kind of stuff than I do. I thought I was the one doing the computer course, so I was quite...
anyway, Okay, so Telnet supports authenticating via username and password, but the caveat to this is that everything, including that username and password, is sent in clear text. So anyone can get that username and password, and anyone can get any other data you send via Telnet. So just remember that.
Anyone connected to your either your network or the network of the person you're telnetting to, or someone who's put like a thing on one of your machines.
Yeah, anyone malicious, any bad guy, if they want it, can just get it. It's no problem if they can get into your network.
And with the proper application to capture such things.
Not hard.
Wireshark.
Oh, that'll do it.
No, not hard.
In fact, Wireshark will actually decode it all for you and show you the usernames and passwords in a nice little scrolly click window, so you don't even have to work for it.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh. Fantastic.
Inaccessible for us, though, fairly much.
Yeah, it's a totally awesome program that we can't use.
That's sad.
Used to be,
But yeah, anyway, I would think, Luke, that your dad actually just what he did was enter in your default gateway address like you've done all the time, just in Safari, and just click that reboot button because he was connected to your wireless network, wasn't he?
Yeah, but no, because he didn't tell me, he didn't reboot it. He turned it off, which was quite strange because suddenly I didn't have internet. And then he goes, oh, sorry about that. And he went back in and turned it back on again.
He probably turned off the wireless.
No, I think it was the whole thing.
You can turn off the wireless portion of a router, I think, without actually, like, turning off the router itself.
You can actually, like, hit a button on some routers to turn the wireless on and off.
That's kind of cool. That's what it does.
Yeah.
Okay, moving right along.
Well, there's two with some router firmwares that'll let you actually configure the use of the button.
Okay. So, as I said, no authentication's great, but, you don't really. It's false sense of security there because they can get your password anyway.
Unless it's secure Telnet, which is a different kettle of fish, which we're not talking about, but there is actually a secure version of Telnet, and if you are using that, then that is safe.
Okay, so we're going to talk about modems, and these are actually not DSL modems, but like 56K modems that you're probably not going to see anymore. They take.
Yeah, you'll still see
they modulate your. They're not so much. They modulate and demodulate signals, so your digital signal turns into analog, goes over the telephone wire, the modem at the receiving end picks it up, turns it back into digital so that you can see it. there are still some really old non-plug-and-play modems that you may have to jumper and set different jumper settings for them. Other than that, I don't think you'll see many of those, but they talk about it in the book. You also got regular plug-and-play modems. These internal modems usually are in a PCI slot, and you put them in, screw them in, install the drivers just like you would install the drivers for a regular, like, NIC, and then you plug in your phone line. Yes, that. It uses an RJ11 connector instead of an RJ45 connector, so it's a smaller connector. And then you go into dial-up networking in XP or find your adapter in Windows 7, put in your information, the number that needs to be dialed, username and password, all that good stuff, hit connect, and it dials up and puts you on the internet.
Does anybody remember the bad old days of WIN modems that were embedded in the sound card, the first generation ones, so that as soon as you dialed onto the internet, it would go, connecting, da, da, da.
Oh, yes!
I don't know if I.
It was sort of
slur
out the Jaws speech.
In other people's places.
Yeah, they'd slur out the Jaws speech because the sound card resources were being utilized by the modem channel and all the Jaws would go slow.
Did it do it the whole time you were on the.
No, just during the dial phase.
Just when you were.
But then the whole sound card system would become really sluggish and horrible.
Yeah, and you'd have to redial like every 2 hours maximum anyway.
I got really annoyed that the later modems, the dial sound started to emanate from, like, the PC speaker or the computer itself.
That's cool.
I actually
cool.
liked the fact that it would come through the speakers. I actually liked that.
Yeah, that's what I'd get. It would the sound would come from the actual tower.
I didn't like that, but I think a lot of people prefer.
It's good because you can actually tell whether it's dialing. Previously, you just sort of sat there and you couldn't actually tell whether there was a dial tone or not. And it would also help if you'd actually dialed somebody's number and you'd put the number in wrong and somebody was at the other end of the phone going, "Hello? Hello?" You wouldn't be able to tell.
Well, no, because the first computer we had, the modem tones came through the sound card itself. They were two separate things, but you could hear the whole dialing out the main speakers and stuff. It was really cool.
Yeah, it does that with a lot of the modern ones as well. There's a little bit that you set in the registers that say, "Let me hear what's going on during the dial phase." And with a lot of the WIN modems that are popular in computers now, because it's just like one little chip on a circuit board, you just set this bit in the register and it just comes out through the sound card because it's essentially wired into the same circuitry.
Modems that use the plain old telephone line are use dial-up networking or DUN. If you have a Braille sense, you'll see Bluetooth DUN, and that stands for Bluetooth dial-up networking, just as a point. They use point-to-point or point-to-point PPP or point-to-point protocol. That's what it's called. And that's important because I think it is on one of your tests that, and this is actually creating a connection between one computer and another computer. So every time that you make a connection, it actually holds that connection open until you're done using it. After the line connection has been established, a handshake sequence takes place between the two modems and the computer. This is a series of short communications that occur between the two of them. It's done to establish the readiness of the two modems and computers to engage in exchange of data.
Does anybody remember that? It sort of goes...
Oh, yeah. And depending on what speeds the modems were and what speed they had decided to connect at, they would sound different, too.
If you were me, you can actually tell by the retrain what sort of modem was dialing from the other end. And you could go, "Hey, that's a US Robotics." But that's just sad.
Good lord.
Still got one.
Wow.
Mine got hit by lightning. I was so very sad because they're a really good modem, the US Robotics, and they've got really funky answering machine and voice stuff built into them that hardly anybody knows about.
I remember just random garden path. Does anyone, maybe this was just a New Zealand thing, but the BrailleLite 2000 used to be able to do email in this country. So you could connect the BrailleLite 2000 to a dial-up modem, and it was very, very weird.
The Millennium you could. I don't know about the 2000.
Yeah, the Millennium had one. The Millennium actually had a modem port.
You could. I guess I could see how you could in 2000, though, because you could plug into the serial port.
Yeah,
it did have serial modems.
Yeah, I think that's all modems were.
Yeah, all modems were pretty much serial if they weren't internal. So you just plug a cable into a modem, and then you could dial on, and you could do pop email on the Braille light thing. On a lot of the note takers, would you do it? You could do it ever since. You could do it on the Sense too. Not the Sense. The Braille.
Braille what?
No, the earlier one. The Blazer.
No, Braille and Squeak.
Yeah, the Braille and Squeak. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
They were actually for a while selling a kit in the early 90s that contained an external modem and a copy of a terminal that you could get onto a shell account with.
We've got a section here on at commands and Hayes compatible modems. This is so old and you will not be tested on it.
I'll just summarize very quickly. Yeah, I used it at the beginning of the year. We went over to East and we had 2G connectivity. And you could either install Nokia PC Suite and bog down your netbook to the point of unusability, or you could ask Kerry what the bizarre AT command sequence was for the modem, and then you'd feed that into the extra commands and it would go like a mad thing. So basically there are commands that start with AT, pardon me. AT means attention, and you can do things like ATH, which will hang the modem, ATDT, dial tone, AT and C1, which will set your carrier to text state, all sorts of AT commands that I happen to still remember and nobody else does. So if you need them, look them up. But there are actually some extra AT commands you can use. For example, if you connect to a Bluetooth serial port on your mobile phone, you can send SMSs through Hyperterminal if you know the correct AT commands.
No way!
Yes, nice. Way!
Holy crap, I'm sorry.
It's like AT-SMS equals number, comma, quote, text, quote, and it just goes blink and off it goes.
Wow.
So why would you do that? What's the advantage to doing that?
Because it's faster than typing, and if you have your mobile phone connected to your computer via Bluetooth, you can then send alerts when things happen on your computer and it can SMS you and go, "Oh, somebody's using my computer."
Because that would be cool.
Why?
Does it save you any...
That would be more... That would just be more trouble than it'd be worth, I'd think.
Well, if you think about notification systems, you might need to know if somebody's broken into a building or tripped a door seal. You can actually have the computer monitoring it and then tell the modem to SMS you and go, oi, somebody's broken into the building. And if the mobile phone sends a text message, there's no screaming sirens, so the burglar thinks that they've got away with it scot-free until the security people turn up.
Or he actually does get away with it because you had your phone in the wrong hip pocket and went partying then.
Well, there is that.
Yeah, that too. Okay, so 8.9.3, you can look over. You're basically not going to be tested on too much of 8.9.3 at all. That's just what we went over. But if you feel like it, it's just really old nostalgic stuff.
It is used if you're establishing a data connection through your mobile phone via Bluetooth, because it does use a Bluetooth serial port, and this is stuff that the BrailleSense does behind the scenes without you having to worry about it, unless you're using a really old phone where you actually have to specifically set the access point. And that was a problem we used to have. If you didn't set the access point, you couldn't connect, so you had to go AT plus rah-rah equals all sorts of weird stuff. So you shouldn't have to do it, but if you do, it's there. And there's lots of documents on Indian websites that tell you how to do it, because they've got lots of mobile internet over there.
All right, we are going to talk about other technologies besides modems used to establish the internet connectivity. We are going to talk about telephone. There are a couple of different ways, but one of them is just using the plain old telephone, and there are several different services that you can actually look at. So before you commit to any type of internet connection, you've got to research what's available to determine the best solution to match your needs or the needs of your customer. We've got the analog telephone, which uses your standard voice line as a modem, and we just talked about that. So that's going to be your plain old dial-up, and that goes at 56K per second.
They call it the POTS, plain old telephone system.
Plain old telephone, so yes, they do. Yeah, well, that's basically it. The first, there are a couple of disadvantages. The first is that the telephone lines cannot be used for voice calls while the modem is in use. And I'm sure everybody has seen this. The second, and everybody is very well aware of this one, is that you have very limited bandwidth provided by a phone. So the maximum, as we said, and that's a big maximum, you're probably going to get nowhere near this, is 56 kbps. In reality, as it says...
The reason I said if you were lucky is because I used to know someone who was, I think, out in Western Australia somewhere, who still, to this day, uses 32.2 kbps dial-up. You don't want to try sending her an album.
There's 33.6. The next fallback speed from 33.6 is 28.8. So that's okay. I think you got your twos and threes around the wrong way. Just to give people an idea of the data transfer speed, 2400 bits per second was equivalent to 800 kilobytes an hour. And at 56K, you'd be looking at a meg every 4.5 minutes, which still makes Facebook unpleasant to load on a modem. Trust me.
The thing, when where I used to live, it was usually either 21.6 or 24,000 was all we could get up to because the phone lines were just really bad, I guess.
I was apparently really lucky because I'd tend to get connected at 50 kbps for the most part.
Yeah,
Between 48 and 52, usually.
Yeah, we used to get that as well. I used to be able to pull down 400 meg a day in 12 hours at 56K. I could do that in about 10 minutes on broadband.
Goodness. That's one album. Okay,
yep.
So the next advancement in our WAN services is ISDN, which is Integrated Services Digital Network. It is used for sending voice, video, and data over normal telephone wires. That's an answer to a question that you guys have on a worksheet, guys. ISDN technologies use telephone wires as an analog telephone service, but they use digital technology to carry the data. Because it uses digital technology, it's going to provide higher quality voice and higher speed data transfer than your regular plain old telephone service. They offer three services: basic rate interface, BRI, primary rate interface, PRI, and broadband ISDN, BISDN. ISDN uses two different types of communications channels. The B channel carries information, which might be data, voice, or video. And then, this is another question on this worksheet, the D channel is used for controlling and signaling, but it also can be used for data. It's usually used for control, though. Next, we have DSL, which is an always-on technology. For the other two, you have to dial in. For this, you're always going to be online unless you unplug your modem or something like that.
What does that stand for again? I don't remember.
Digital subscriber line. This uses the telephone lines again to provide high-speed digital data communications between end users and telephone companies. A lot of people in Australia and New Zealand have this because cable hasn't really gotten here yet.
It shouldn't. It should actually stand for Don't Search LimeWire, but it does stand for Digital Subscriber Line.
I like that.
So unlike the ISDN, where it's all a digital line, DSL is able to share the phone line with the analog signals. So the telephone company limits the bandwidth of the analog line so that your digital internet can still get through. You're going to have to use a filter, but you can get filters for each line where you actually plug a telephone into, and then you're actually able to talk on the phone and be on the internet at the same time, which was pretty revolutionary.
There is another way of doing it, too. You can get a splitter, which does the same thing, except that's a very weird way that we used to do it because we needed a separate connection for our burglar alarm. But what that means is if you do it with a splitter, you can only plug your DSL modem or whatever into one particular jack point in the house. So I found out to my sorrow when I tried to plug it into the wrong connection one time. But you can only plug it into a certain RJ11?
Yeah, you can. The reason they do that is because if you're doing ADSL 2 or ADSL 2 Plus, it actually makes more sense to install a single filter splitter, because they're of much higher quality than the lower quality little crud things you buy from, you know, Yaldi electronics shop that you can put on each phone point. It's also recommended for ADSL 2 Plus connections that you actually put a filter on all of the unused phone sockets as well. That can help.
They actually don't even go into filters in this anymore. They just say get a splitter, and that's how you do it. But that changed from last semester. There's one other consideration that you need to be aware of with DSL, and that's the distance from the exchange. As you get farther away, because these are analog telephone lines, the signal diminishes. So if you're really close to the DSLAM, where you get your DSL, you're going to get really fast speeds. If you're far away, your speeds are going to get slower, and you're not going to have as reliable internet.
Here they tend to refer to it as, how far are you from your telephone company central office, is what they call it.
Yeah.
Is where I'm at. Or the exchange.
What magnitudes of speed reduction are we talking here? I mean,
we're talking 24 megabytes per second down to 100 kilobytes per second.
Mm. Wow.
With a drop out nothing, every 45 seconds.
But it's not like, I mean, it's not a subtle thing. So like if you had 6 megs down and you were getting 4, you wouldn't that wouldn't have anything to do with
it. Yeah. Yeah. It totally could.
The distance is from 0 to 3 kilometers from the exchange, and the further you move away from that exchange, 2.9 kilometers, 2.8 kilometers, the speed will fall as the line attenuates. So distance is critical.
That's why DSL is not going to be available in some areas, because it's too far away.
So there are a couple different types of DSL. The most common type is ADSL, and this is asymmetric DSL. It has different bandwidth capabilities for each direction. So it'll have a fast download speed, typically 1.5 megabits, but probably more. Actually now, this is old. Downstream is the process of transferring data from the server end to the user, and it's beneficial for users who download large amounts of data, such as the home user. The rate of upload is going to be slower. It does not perform well when hosting a web server or FTP server, which involve uploading more than downloading.
Torrents, anyone? If you're on a really bad mismatched DSL service, you can have a heck of a time maintaining your seed ratios, especially if you're charged for both uploads and downloads.
People get angry if you don't seed Linux distributions for long enough.
That's right.
So a common ADSL configuration, or used to be, is 1.5 down, 384 up.
It was 1.5 down, 256 up.
Okay, this one says 384, so they're being generous.
Yeah, you could actually get 8 megabits down and 1 megabit up on ADSL 1, but it was very rare.
You've got a very nice diagram here that talks all about all sorts of different types of DSL and ISDN lines and all of that, so I would have a look at that, because some of the answers for that worksheet that I was mentioning to you are in it. The next bit we're going to talk about is power line communication. And I've never seen this work, but apparently we have some of these. Power line communication, or PLC, is a communications method that uses power distribution wires for the local electric grid to send and receive data. It's known also as power line networking, mains communication, power line telecoms. And basically, an electric company can superimpose an analog signal over a standard 50 or 60 hertz AC adapter. The analog signal can carry voice and data signals. You can also make this happen in your house. You don't actually need the power line company to do it. What you do is plug in the power line cable to your modem and plug it into the outlet, I believe, and then you can plug another port into another outlet and plug your computer into it, and you've got power over your Ethernet over power lines.
That's actually a box that's got a power socket on one side and an RJ45 on the other. You plug the power socket into the wall, and you plug the Ethernet plug into either a machine or a hub or switch, and you have two of them, and you can get, depending on how fast you've got them, some of them are 300 megabits per second. I've got some 85 megabit ones that'll run a signal from any power point in the house to any other power point in the house, provided they are on the same circuit. So if you've got three phase, you're in trouble. If they're on different circuits, you can't do it.
They say that this is going to get more popular, but it's never caught on, basically, as Luke said, because it would be so weird.
No, the reason it hasn't caught on is because none of the power companies can cooperate with any of the telecommunications companies. That's what it boils down to.
That makes sense.
Okay, so broadband is a technology used to transmit multiple signals using multiple frequency over one cable. For example, cable TV. We all know about cable internet, right? You have your cable TV and your internet, and they can also throw in a VoIP phone line now. So you've got three services in one. Because the two transmission types do not interfere with each other, because they're on different frequencies. So DSL technically is not going to be a broadband service, even though they call it DSL broadband. Cable is, because the cable TV and the cable internet use two completely different frequencies.
So does DSL on the phone line?
Not quite. They interfere with each other still some, so that's why you need a filter. Does that make sense?
Seriously, guys, you're probably going to have to listen to this lecture through twice, because you don't get it all the first time through. Put it onto your Victor Reader stream or listening device of choice, your iThing. Actually, which brings up an interesting point. You can't put bookmarks in MP3s, can you, on the iThing? I didn't think you could. You can with M4Bs, but I didn't think you could with MP3s.
No.
Go ahead. What were you going to say? Actually, DSL is technically broadband.
You can get it to treat an MP3 as a book, and I can explain to anyone who wants to know about that later, but no, I don't think you can put bookmarks on the iThing.
You can convert MP3 into MP4 with iSwoon, and then you can rename M4A to M4B, and then you can add bookmarks. But let's not go there.
Okay, so technically, Drew's right. Cable, DSL, ISDN, and satellite are all broadband technologies. I don't understand that, because ISDN and DSL do interfere with each other, so if somebody can clear that up...
You can have ISDN... ISDN can have... D channels and B channels.
Yeah, no, I know that.
And it can have DSL. It can have phone service and data on the same ISDN line. That was quite common.
Right, I knew that, but don't they interfere with each other?
No, it just shares the bandwidth out. You get half for one and half for the other. So interfere wouldn't be the right word. It just multiplexes it, and if you're on the phone, your data can go slower.
I've actually seen like people in FM radio use ISDN. If like they want to do a show in a location where they don't have a studio, they'll just like bring a microphone and Zephyr and ISDN and plug into like hotels ISDN line.
Yeah, a lot of radio stations used to use that technology to shovel audio around over various links to get it to the radio station or whatever if the transmitter happened to be a couple of clicks away.
Okay. Bluetooth devices can connect up to 7 other Bluetooth devices to create a wireless personal area network, or WPAN. They just used to call those personal area networks. It's described by the 802.15.1 standard. They don't ask you about that, so don't worry about that standard. Not a number you need to remember. These devices are capable of handling voice and data, and we all know about common Bluetooth characteristics, but they're divided into 3 classifications. Class 1 has an approximate range of 100 meters, or 330 feet. Class 2 has a range of approximately 10 meters, 33 feet, and Class 3 has a range of approximately 1 meter, or 3 feet. I've never seen a Class 3 Bluetooth device. Anyone else?
What about your phone earpiece? Aren't they fairly...
Really? I think they would be a Class 2.
I'm guessing.
Some earpieces were Class 3. The other thing you've got to keep in mind with Bluetooth especially is that it's 100 meters line of sight. Brick wall tends to stop it pretty well.
Bluetooth operates in the 2.4 to 2.485 gigahertz radio frequency range, just like your old mobile phones, which is in the industrial, scientific, and medical ISM band, which is basically everything uses that band. So you can get a lot of interference. It actually incorporates adaptive frequency hopping, which is really cool because it allows the signals to actually hop around and use different frequencies within the Bluetooth range so that it will reduce the chance of that interference I was just talking about. And we've got cellular, which is awesome because it enables voice, video, and data. And with a Cellular One adapter installed in a laptop or just doing it over Bluetooth, you can access the internet over the cellular network, which is very, very cool because that means you can have internet just about anywhere, although slower than some DSL and cable connections because actually now cellular is getting quite fast. It's still pretty fast and actually fast enough to be classified as high speed as long as you're not doing 2G. If you're 3G, it's high speed.
You can now get the internet on top of Mount Everest.
Wow.
Yep, I saw.
You can review the technologies that cell phones use because we went through that in Module 6 anyway, so I'm not actually going to go over that again because we did a pretty thorough job of doing that last time. We talked about cable and getting the internet from the cable company. Yes, you can get internet from actually a cable TV company in the States. It runs on the same line as your cable TV, so you get cable and internet through the same cable.
Talk about trippy. You can get cable from your telephone provider.
That's usually satellite, isn't it?
No, that's fiber, which I assume, I don't know if that talks about fiber or not.
Okay, not too much. I don't think that's
it should, really too much. Fiber's the feature, man.
Yeah.
You can do telephone over your cable line, is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's VoIP.
Or I think some of the cable companies
which is
are
equally
using
weird.
Yet another part of the because the Time Warner digital cable
that
we had didn't sound
weird.
Like VoIP. It sounded really, really...
Well, here, Verizon has what they call Vios, which also has very similar.
Yeah, that's fiber.
That's a fiber like type of thing, isn't it?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. And we've got satellite, which is an alternative for customers who are in remote areas and can't get cable or DSL. It does not require a phone line or cable, but uses a satellite dish for two-way communications. Download speeds are typically up to 500 kbps, and uploads are closer to 56 kbps. It takes time for the signals to go up to the satellite dish to relay to your ISP through the satellite orbiting the Earth, so it can be slow, and it can drop out quite a bit.
This was really weird. We had a student who was on satellite in 2007, and if you called him up on Skype, it was fine. And then if he got in on Ventrilo, his audio would go...
I know another satellite person who was like that.
Yeah, it just... And Skype worked beautifully.
Skype
and then
can
the
actually
actual,
scale
yeah.
down really well when it realizes that, hey, I can't use a whole lot of bandwidth. It can do a really nice job of cutting back.
Yeah, newer Skype algorithms have gotten better at it. So if you're not running Skype 5, you should be. It's actually got a much better adaptive bandwidth calculation. In fact, it was vastly improved in 4.2. So if you're still running Skype 3.8 because you're a diehard, then we're just going to laugh at you when it doesn't adapt itself properly.
Get 5.
Get 5 is right.
Works well with NVDA.
Works well with just about any screen reader. It's pretty cool.
And you can have a look at watch your Facebook. Okay, moving right along.
I did that for about a week, and then I just couldn't be bothered anymore. watch my Facebook. Okay, so it actually does talk about fiber now, which is the king of the internet connections. It's the fastest. It's the best. Very fast. Can go very far and do advanced features like video conferencing. A single fiber pair can carry millions of phone calls, as compared to a single copper pair, which can carry 6 phone calls. I've never actually seen that statistic, so I thought it was cool. Any questions on any of the broadband methods?
This stuff is in one of your worksheets, so when that worksheet comes up, just go to the end of the lecture and have a bit of a listen.
Yeah, basically, I've just given you the answers to the entire worksheet and anything I haven't. Well, it's all in these diagrams down here.
So you might want to use the jump to time feature of your Victorita stream and jump to about, well, I don't know how long the lecture will be once I slice the gaps out, but that's something you can mess with.
Wikipedia is also interesting information about the different broadband types as well.
Does anybody not know what VoIP is? I think we mostly do because we use Skype and Ventrilo, right? Any questions on VoIP? Cool. All right. Final thing we're going to do is VPN, which is a virtual private network. It's a private network that uses a public network, like the internet, to connect remote sites or users together. So it uses a dedicated secure connection routed through the internet from a company's private network to the remote user. When you're connected to the network, you become a part of that company network and have access to all services and resources as if you were physically there connected to their LAN sitting in your office. You need
My
a
mom
remote
did something like this VPN. When she did log me in when she was in the hospital and she was able to get work done on her company computer.
Yeah, I used to open VPN into my email when I was in the States to get email from the GOTS server and to send email through the GOTS server. There's a really nice diagram here that shows how connecting to a VPN actually works, and I enjoyed reading it, so you guys probably will too. Any questions on any of that? Has everybody's brains completely turned to mush?
These lectures are so long.
Yes, I know. That's why we're going to cut them down to an hour and a half and do 2 a week. You so don't want your brains to explode.
So fiber is fiber, right? And that's not DSL or anything?
Yeah, fiber is fiber.
Fiber is fiber, and
it's its own category.
Totally
different. Okay.
Yeah, because a line, fiber isn't necessarily classified as a line. It's classified as a fiber. And in fact, Grace had a system in the States last year, which almost makes me want to move over there, where they had so much bandwidth from their ISP that you just watch TV over it as well, because, well, there's bandwidth allocated for TV because it's got like 100 megabits coming
U-verse
in.
Yeah, that's what U-verse is, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I had U-verse. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I'm trying U-verse to get U-verse, so you get it in a couple
and
months.
And you can watch a show on the DVR no matter what TV you're on.
We can do all that. You can do all that with Foxtel too if you know what you're doing. It's an interesting concept and it's a very interesting use of bandwidth and that sort of thing. And then really smart people like the Hulu people in Canada actually record everything that comes down off the cable and sticks it on terabytes and terabytes of hard disk, so you can watch anything you want whenever you want, and you pay like, you know, $2 a month to watch just about anything you want on demand, and that's got a lot of people very scared.
Is that, like, do they encode it at all, or do they just save it and go?
I don't know. they basically just, apparently they buy the cable channels at wholesale rate, and then they just record everything with like Myth TV or whatever, and you just reef it off.
You said this is what Hulu's doing.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago. I don't know whether they still are, but
I believe it's still, yeah, Hulu's still around.
It's still around, but whether they're doing it that way.
Yeah, I think they still are, because apparently you can get the cable channels at wholesale rates, and then if all of the users pay the subscription at the wholesale rate, they're entitled to any of the content that comes off the 30 channels, so they just record everything and just archive it away on hard disks.
You can do quite a bit for Hulu for free, at least you used to be able to. You'd get ads, but they weren't too bad.
Okay, guys, it's time to wake up. The lecture's over. You've got 8 points. You've got your troubleshooting and preventative maintenance chat sections that you guys can read. If you have any questions on those, always email the list. Maybe with the new format, we'll get to go over more of that because we'll have more time.
And also a note.
I've got a question.
Go ahead.
By all means.
The VPN stuff, I've been logging into my emails here at work through, I think it's Outlook Exchange server or something like that. And all I've been doing is reading emails and replying and sending, but it doesn't access all of the LAN resources.
Exchange is not a VPN.
That's what I wanted to clarify. Was it or wasn't it?
Yeah, Exchange is not a VPN. Exchange is Microsoft's funky email system that lets you schedule things and email people, and when it works, it's really great. Connecting to that does not mean you're connecting to the VPN. There are some works that actually force you to connect to a VPN as well as connecting to Exchange because it's actually more secure. There is a remote risk of data interception if you're just connecting to Exchange in raw terms. But yeah, don't tell them that.
Or else you'll get to do VPN.
So I've never heard of UVerse. I'm assuming that's something like... I think it was termed Fios, which I've heard of, which...
UVerse and Fios are competing...
UVerse and Fios are the same, sort of.
They
thing.
Are competing things. UVerse is AT&T, Fios is Verizon. If you have UVerse in a state,
okay.
You got UVerse in that state, you don't have both, because you can only have one at a time. And if
Fair
you have
enough.
Any more
yeah,
questions,
is...
I know somebody who works for Fios, so I can ask her.
So it is the same kind of thing, because I remember a...
Yep.
Certain acquaintance of mine used to, or has Fios and used to talk about it, and in New Zealand internet terms, that was absolutely...
It's kind of insane here, too, still.